around that area. I know there are treaties in place that stop weapons being used in that area. If you see troop movements in that area, they almost look like medieval armies because they're all carrying melee weapons rather than ballistic weapons. There's no guns. So they are making some sort of steps to make peace. But a lot of this is about economic development, which is a big part of it. Obviously, one of the main adversaries in the world as it is today is almost putting the brakes on American interference. So China showing that sort of hand of friendship in aiding co-opting the Indian development together is a really big, important step, I think, and it shows a lot of maturity in the Chinese position.
Mr. McRae, how do you look at India's policy regarding China? Are there any takers for cordial China-India relations in India, or India wants to focus on getting closer to the West, especially the US seeing China as an arch rival in the region?
I think the American position very much wants it to be an arch rival. America have been courting the government of Modi for quite some time in the hope of it being some sort of bulwark against Chinese development. You do see sometimes where it does look like it could go that way and then it somehow tethers the other. I personally don't believe it is going that way. Now, India is obviously a big part of BRICS, which is the development program alongside Russia and China throughout the conflict of last year between Russia and Ukraine. India have been one of the major importers of Russian oil, which is very much sort of putting it in the Chinese sort of block, as you would. If we were talking in sort of Cold War terms, China would be now sort of appearing in the Indian sort of sphere. So I think there is a lot to work out between China and India, but I think in the end, I think economic development will come out as the number one player, and China are India's best hope at that. They're part of the One Belt, One Road initiative, which is obviously going to help a lot of developing nations in that region, which is obviously something that America don't want to see happen.
Mr. McRae, the Chinese foreign minister's remarks regarding the hostile attitude of the US towards the country and its impact on the world politics, do you see any shift in the relation the two countries currently share?
I think we are in the decades of the coming war with China. America have perceived themselves as the number one for so long. Their entire identity is built on being number one, the number one military, the number one economy, and they are very close to losing that position. And I think it's like a child losing its toy. It's going to lash out. And I think in the way it's going to lash out is in the form of a conflict with China. It is a conflict that I do believe that they are destined to lose. It does seem to be poised towards the territory of Taiwan. Obviously, the world are in this difficult situation with Taiwan where nobody recognizes it as a country, but behave that it is a country as such. They carry on arming it, where it is, in fact, a breakaway country. It is the result of a civil war that they lost. And any other territory in the world would treat it as such. If India or Iran won a civil war against part of its breakaway section, that breakaway section wouldn't then be able to make diplomatic demands as Taiwan has been doing.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
For Kashmir, 2022 was a year of misfortunes, with New Delhi introducing new policies to integrate the region into the Indian Union. The BJP government in India continues to follow in the Israeli regime's footsteps in Kashmir in a bid to change the Muslim-majority region's demography. In the latest development, India has implemented a law that allows leasing governmental land to outsiders. This move is aimed at further disempowering and alienating the local Muslim population of the region.
Since the abrogation of Article 370 in August 2019, the Himalayan region of Kashmir has lost its limited autonomy. In the last 3 years, changing the land policies has been the prime focus of the BJP government in New Delhi. As the region doesn't have an elected state government and is directly ruled by New Delhi, the central government has time and again passed orders in the past few years to allow non-local residents to settle, work, and buy property in the Kashmir Valley. The central government's anti-Kashmir policies have led to fear and apprehension of demographic change among the local Muslim population. The rules lately introduced by the government require local traders to return the land lease from the government. According to the government order, anyone not adhering to the rule will be forcefully evicted from the property. The land can now be bought by non-Kashmiris, paving the way to establish settlements in the valley on the model of Israeli settlements in occupied Palestinian territories. Hospitality, being one of the important sectors in the state, is also facing the brunt of this policy as the government has decided to auction the properties and permits leaving hundreds of Kashmiris associated with the sector on the brink of joblessness.
The past year has also witnessed increased persecution of journalists working in the Kashmir region. The homes of several journalists have been raided, with scores being summoned by the police. According to analysts, this move has been designed to silence the media and prevent it from publishing news deemed controversial or critical of New Delhi. This has instilled fear amongst journalists working in the region, as they have been abstaining from reporting about the politics of the region.
With media in Kashmir operating in an atmosphere of fear, the coverage of local dailies is now limited to state-sponsored events, portraying an all-colorful governmental picture of the valley. New Delhi has been resorting to tough laws such as the Public Safety Act, which incurs 2 years in jail without trial. Many journalists have been booked under this act past year. It has further terrified the journalistic fraternity in the Himalayan region, which has already been maintaining silence since the abrogation of Article 370 by the BJP government in New Delhi. According to the annual World Press Freedom Index conducted by Reporters Without Borders, India has dropped from 142nd to 150th rank in the past year. The same report calls India one of the worst countries for media persons. The situation in Kashmir is more worrisome, as reporters are harassed by the police and the paramilitary forces on a regular basis. In a bid to control and intimidate journalists working in the valley, the government last year closed the doors of the Kashmir Press Club, a democratically elected journalistic body. The Indian government has also been restricting Kashmiri journalists from international travel. A Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist was recently barred by the government from traveling to receive her award.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Munir Ahmed from Islamabad. He's a senior journalist and political analyst. Mr. Ahmed, first of all, welcome to the program. Now, how do you view the recent land rules issued by the government? Is this an attempt to change the demography of the state of Jammu and Kashmir and a bid to change this Muslim majority status?
From August 5th, 2019, Indian government is trying to change the demographic status of Muslims in Indian illegally occupied Kashmir, and the new land rules is also one of them. And since the annexation of Kashmir with India, they are trying in many ways to change the demographic position status of population over there. And certainly, they have already taken several other steps as well. And they have given several hectares of land to different people living in other cities of India. And they are giving many leases agreements to them so that they could establish their own businesses in India. And land reforms, the new land reforms, quote unquote, would certainly is an attempt to give all the land of Indian illegally occupied Kashmir to the Indian businessmen. Those resources of occupied Kashmir would being transferred to the non-locals, and that is really a terrible situation. Though the international community is voicing against the annexation of August 5, but still India is not hearing the voices of the people and voices of the locals, though they are protesting on the streets, and they have been under curfew for around 3 years. Having curfew and changing the demographic position in Indian illegally occupied Kashmir is a right point of concern for Pakistan as well, and for the entire Muslim communities across the world as well.
Now, Mr. Ahmed, hospitality is one of the most important business sectors in the valley. The government has decided not to extend the lease of the local hoteliers and open the option of lease auction for the non-locals as well. Do you see this as an attempt to break the economic backbone of Kashmir?
Hospitality is certainly a big business for Kashmiri people, and they have been doing wonderful business, and most of the international tourism in India is based on what the Indian illegally occupied Kashmir offers. They have wonderful places, lakes, and the environment they have is really a sellable commodity in terms of tourism. Now, the Indian government is giving all the leases of the hotels and all the other facilities of the tourism to non-locals. That is really a dent to the entire economy of the local. They have already given the other buildings owned by the government and the institutions, even owned by the private sector, to the non-locals over there to do businesses. And the agricultural lands, as I mentioned, has already been given to non-locals. The entire interventions by the government are mean to dent the to weaken the Muslim community living in the occupied Kashmir. And this is really terrible and against the international norms. And the people are, the local people are protesting. Surely they have reservations, and the international community shall come up to help them out. And in the wake of new Cold War, they will be having economic recession in the coming days as well. As you have seen that the economy is becoming weaker and weaker post-COVID. So in this situation, these government interventions will be killing the local economy, especially make more weaker the Muslim communities there.
Mr. Ahmed, let's talk about the mauling, the freedom of press, and also the clampdown on the journalists. Is New Delhi sending across the word that no voice of dissent can be tolerated?
Indian government has banned media in occupied Kashmir. And even they banned the visit of the international community over there, especially the UN observers. Were not allowed to go in the occupied Kashmir so that they could not observe what has been happening over there. And more than 50 journalists have been killed in the recent years. And this is quite alarming that they have canceled declarations of many print media and electronic media. YouTube channels, the web-based channels are already banned. And such kind of imposition of ban on the voice of the locals is really worrisome. I believe like this is a strangulation of the voice of freedom they are raising in Kashmir. And it should be condemned. And if you have seen last year and even in 2020, the Human Rights Watch reports have condemned all these atrocities there, and they have also raised a voice for the freedom of press over there, and engaging and allowing the other people go over there and see by themselves. But they were not allowed, and the Indian government is not even bothering by the international reports and all the protests there the locals are carrying out. This is really strange, and I don't know what could be done to convince the Indian government to have Kashmiris their own voice.
Last but not least, sir, how do you see the future of journalism in Kashmir? Can we hope for any good days ahead, or will this atmosphere of fear continue?
I don't see any future of journalism or the business of the local Kashmiri Muslims. As the Indian government has banned all the publications, and there is no internet access at all, and they also have stopped the YouTube transmissions and the access to YouTube and the uploading of such kind of material over there. The journalists cannot report even to international media. If some journalists could reach out to international media or write something about the actual situation in Kashmir, they face consequences. In that context, certainly there is no future of journalism and the Muslim community over there. Again, I would urge UN organizations and other human rights organizations to put Kashmir on their priority agenda. Otherwise, the humanity in Kashmir will be suffering for all the atrocities Indian government are imposing on them.
There you have it, Mr. Munir Ahmed. He's a senior journalist and political analyst from Islamabad. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see what people have to say on social media.
Ittehad al-Muslimin wrote, "People of Jammu and Kashmir will forcefully resist every challenge by New Delhi to change the demography of the state by scrapping Article 35A. Tajammul Islam tweeted, "New J&K land laws are not in the interest of people of Jammu and Kashmir, as these will further widen the gap between New Delhi and people of Jammu and Kashmir. At BJP for India is trying to change the demography of Jammu and Kashmir, which will have serious consequences."
And that was our episode about the controversial land rules being implemented by India in the state of Jammu and Kashmir, and also the China-India relations continuing to nosedive amid simmering border tensions. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinda ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned. One of the main features of humans is making comparison. This is because we are social beings. Humans are not like animals that do not have the comparing power. For animals, same food in the same place does not differ. Humans are different since they consider lower or upper level for themselves. They are also differentiated based on being a believer or non-believer.
ما چون یه موجود اجتماعی هستیم با هم زندگی میکنیم خواه نخواه تو زندگیمون مقایسه میاد.
Since humans are a social being, they live together, and making comparison among them is inevitable. The comparison that a human makes could be on different levels of education, wealth, beauty, and social status. However, making comparison is like a double-edged sword. It could cause both tranquility or calmness and anxiety in one's life. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com/Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., You wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The recent riots in Brazil, affected by political virus from Washington, further weaken U.S. democracy. These riots were so familiar to those who observed the U.S. Capitol riots. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times wrote in this regard, the riots in Brasilia have petered out, but the conundrums facing Washington are just beginning to bubble up. On January 8, supporters of former Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, who refused to accept the results of the presidential election, stormed the country's Congress, Supreme Court, and the presidential palace. The scene is exactly the same as the one which followed the U.S. presidential election 2 years ago. More interestingly, Bolsonaro's governing style had kept itself consistent with that of former U.S. President Donald Trump in recent years. In terms of foreign policy, he aimed at pleasing his political base. In his views, domestic interests are more important than global responsibilities. He followed the decisions of the White House on a number of regional and international affairs. In his last days in office, Bolsonaro flew to Florida and was absent from the inauguration ceremony of Lula da Silva. The self-described definition of identity on whose Twitter account is still President of the Federative Republic of Brazil. On the next day of the Brazilian version of Capitol riots, Bolsonaro tweeted a photo showing himself lying on a hospital bed in Orlando, Florida, eager to disassociate himself from the vicious incident. The former president had repeatedly claimed Brazil's voting system is riddled with fraud and challenged the election he lost. After losing the election, angry Bolsonaro supporters staged protests in many places in Brazil. Democratic Representative Joaquin Castro of Texas accused Brazil's former leader of following Trump's playbook by using false claims
of a rigged election to incite his supporters and cast doubt over the outcomes of a presidential election. Whether Bolsonaro has any connections with the riots is not important. One thing is undeniable. Trump virus, a variant of U.S. democracy, has undermined Brazil. Lula has kick-started his third term as president 12 years after his last presidency. In his first two terms, he dropped the neoliberal development model in the economic field, safeguarded the interests of lower-class civilians politically, promoted social justice, and opposed the U.S. Monroe Doctrine, which sees Latin America as U.S. backyard diplomatically. At one point, like Hugo Chavez, he was an iconic figure in Latin Americans' pink tide or the turn to the left political wave. Lula's clear stance of being revolutionary, independent, and anti-American won widespread favor among the domestic people. He not only won the only re-election since the Brazilian military returned power to the people, but also brought the country into an unprecedentedly strong development cycle. Inevitably, he was also regarded as a thorn in the side of domestic and foreign forces who tried their best to maintain the old order. It is obviously not in the diplomatic interest of the U.S. regime, nor in line with the U.S. so-called values, for such an iconic figure of the Latin American left wing who has a clear political background and conforms to broad public opinion to regain the presidency. However, the White House has completely sided with Lula on the issue of Brasilia riots. Not only did U.S. President Joe Biden immediately express his desire to stand with the Brazilian people on Twitter, but he also issued a brief but clear-cut joint statement with the leaders of Canada and Mexico. Such enthusiastic support for left-wing leaders has amazed international public opinion. The value diplomacy emphasized by the Democratic Party appears to be worthless in this issue. It has made the world understand once again that no matter how U.S. foreign policy is decorated, it cannot escape the womb of double standards. On Capitol Hill, there are significant divisions in line with the executive branch. They control lawmakers from the Democratic Party took all their anger over the January 6 riots out on Bolsonaro. However, the vast majority of lawmakers in the Republican Party opted for selective avoidance, and some have cautiously questioned the demand of ejecting Bolsonaro from the U.S. If the legislative branch no longer allows the executive branch to exercise discretion on the issue of whether he will leave or stay, American democracy will start a new round of mutation. Meanwhile, RT wrote in an op-ed, just as the U.S. was preparing for the second anniversary of its January 6th insurrection, ex-Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro went to Florida following election fallout in his own country. Of all the places in the world, Jair Bolsonaro could have led to following his tumultuous defeat in a runoff election against his left-wing opponent, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. The United States may have been the least expected. After all, here is a country that most wanted men think Julian Assange and Edward Snowden escaped from, not to. Meanwhile, memories of its own so-called insurrection are still fresh in the minds of many Americans, some of whom are now holding the slippery reins of power. On January 6, 2021, following the defeat of then-US President Donald Trump in 2020 presidential election, a throng of his supporters descended upon the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., in the belief that the election had been stolen. A similar script played out recently in Brasilia, the Brazilian capital, as Bolsonaro supporters ransacked Congress and the Supreme Court and surrounded the presidential palace in yet another check in the armor of computer-controlled elections. The violence, which the former right-wing president formally condemned, forced Lula to call for a state of emergency in the capital until January 31st. By comparison, although Trump quickly committed himself to an orderly transition of power, Bolsonaro didn't stick around to hand over the ceremonial presidential sash to Lula da Silva at the inauguration, a bold decision that the new Brazilian leader will not soon forget or forgive. Rather than stepping aside, the former Brazilian incumbent fled to the Republican stronghold of Florida, which was certainly no accident considering that the Sunshine State is home to both Donald Trump and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. This may prove invaluable should Lula make an extradition request for Bolsonaro. It would probably come as no surprise that the Democrats, a party that never misses a chance to change in political theater, are already doing exactly that. In the short term, Bolsonaro's American rendezvous shields him from any immediate legal tangles in Brazil, where he is under investigation in at least four criminal inquiries. But it goes without saying that Da Silva, who was in prison during Bolsonaro's 2019 inauguration on graft convictions that were later dismissed, would like nothing more than to exact some poetic justice on his ideological nemesis. That much was obvious in a thinly veiled threat Lula delivered to his predecessor.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. It takes courage to grow up and become who you really are. However, this growth and upbringing has a major play by parents. And in this program, we try to guide the parents how to take the proper steps to upbring their children in, under the umbrella of Islam. And the answers to your questions, issues are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
The listeners, Professor Nakavi is a researcher in the Hawza Ilmi of Qom and also a faculty member at Al-Mustafa University. So, Professor Nakavi, a very warm welcome again.
Thank you very much.
So, Professor Nakavi, one of the beautiful things that you have said in the previous episode was that we can use virtual world to learn about natural world. Now, in this episode, I want to ask you how. How can we learn about natural world using the virtual one?
So one of the very beautiful things about the virtual world is that it is becoming a repository of knowledge and information.
Yeah.
About everything, anything you can find on it. And sometimes I would like to, for example, in a lighter mood, we say Ayatollah Google.
Yeah.
So if you turn to Google, you find the answer, any ayah, holy verse you want, any ayah, any hadith, anything you can find on it. Or for example, the sources like Wikipedia. Though one is very much concerned about the hands behind them.
Yeah.
But still they are...
At the same time, they're providing a lot of information.
Yes. So tomorrow... Everything is going to be, all our knowledge, the treasure of human knowledge would be based on, and would be rooted in this, would be there, is there already, and shall continue to develop in the future. So we need to, number one, develop the right approach, the principles, the ethics and morals of how to benefit from them. Just as you would, for example, when we're talking about studying, we have the how to study properly, how to benefit from the book, how do we read properly, how do we carry out fast reading, how do we make points, how do we make summaries. I mean, this is all a part of our...
Techniques that you're using.
Skills and techniques which we are using in for learning.
Yeah.
So the same sort of techniques can apply to the virtual world and learning from the virtual world. But beyond that, even in the natural sense, when we're studying, when we're reading, when we're educating ourselves, when we're being educated by others, there are certain morals which we have to take care of. Well, for example, how do we treat our students, how our students treat us as teachers, how they behave. There are morals and ethics to it. So we need to develop a set of morals and ethics to be able to deal with the virtual world and how to learn from it, the do's and the do nots.
Yeah.
They need to be developed and understood. And of course, today there's a philosophical debate about the virtual reality.
Yeah.
What is it? How do we define that reality? Is it a reality in what sense is it real?
Yeah.
In the natural sense. So we have a philosophical
debate over it.
That's a very important debate, which is to be done at the academic level. I mean, this personality which is coming up in the form of a virtual, it's made up of. Bits and pieces which are not real pieces. They're not human beings. They are just images.
Yeah.
Made up of energy.
Okay.
So there's a definition of that. Then there's the philosophical aspect. Then there's the meaning. What are the meanings that are being conveyed through these images? So there's a great deal of debate about this today.
Yes. We'll discuss more on this after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab with Professor Nakavi, and we're saying about the virtual world, the relationship of virtual world of a teenager and how he can reach to natural environment or learn about natural environment through the virtual world.
So we need to benefit from this, as I mentioned previously also. The learning which has to be taken from this virtual world has to be such that it does not disconnect us, number one, from Allah Almighty. Number two, it should not disconnect us from the natural world also.
Okay.
I mean, today, yes, tomorrow, today we are communicating. I mean, today you have this, for example, there's a caricature about two people are sitting across the table, and instead of talking to each other in the natural way, they are
typing
their messages to each other, and they feel more comfortable in typing their messages
rather than talking to face.
And expressing their views verbally.
Yeah.
So that is a problem. So communication in the natural sense is being disrupted.
Yeah.
And tomorrow, beyond that, when this technology advances, and I know I can't just think of the dimensions which it takes, and the disconnection from the real world becomes so extended and expansive, that is the problem which we are going to face. All human contact, communication and contact may end up in the virtual world.
Yeah, it was revealed that the maker of the Instagram app said to the programmer that as the teens and youth are involved in drugs, I want you to make a program or an app in a way that they become more and more used to this app than drugs themselves. So, and we see teens more and more engaged on it, and they are being... It's a kind of app wherein you gotta be posting everything, whatever, wherever you go, and that too in the form of pictures or videos. How do we help our teens in this very dangerous field? Because the program is designed in a way that would make a teenager addictive.
And very rightly so, that you, I mean, not, you becoming addictive to drugs may cause a person to carry out suicide. And there are games being developed which lead to suicide through games themselves. So they are very difficult. Again, it comes back to controlling the minds and the thoughts and the feelings of our youth in a way that they are not overwhelmed and awed by it. So, I mean, they need to understand what the ultimate reality is. They need to develop that connection with their Lord, Allah Almighty. They need to develop themselves in such a way that they know what is the purpose they are living for. And this has to be enshrined in our own lives. It has to become, we have to become role models. We have to, if we're not role models, then we have to make them connected to people who can provide them that way of life and show them the path. Every teenager, every human being, especially every teenager, has to have a mentor.
Yes,
there's no doubt about that. We in Islam, there's a great deal of stress upon attaching ourselves to a past person who is a sage, who is a wise person, who has wisdom,
who can act as your guide,
who can show us the path.
Yes.
Not just teach us, guide us.
Guide us. So what's the difference? I'll ask you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqavi. And Professor Naqavi, before going to the break, you said that Islam really emphasizes us to have a mentor, a guide who is not a teacher, but who is a guide who shows you the path. Now, who do you call this teacher? You said he's not just a teacher, he's a guide.
He's a mentor. A teacher teaches you, imparts knowledge to you. Knowledge is not the only ingredient in your behavior. You may know everything, but you may not act upon it. There's a motivation. Incentive has to be provided for that action. You know praying is good. Hijab is necessary, but we don't act upon it. So where's the motivation?
So having knowledge is not enough.
Having knowledge is not enough. Having knowledge, ilm, is not enough.
There should be some motivator.
Faith, love, motivation, and the practical skills. And the guide is beyond a teacher, is more than a teacher. The mentor, the teacher shows you the path. This is the path towards salvation. The guide goes beyond us, before us, teaches that path, that destination.
So he practically himself
and
goes.
Comes back to take us along with him.
Wow. Okay.
I mean, you can stand at the foot of the mountain and show this is the path to the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
The teacher will show you, but the guide will take you up.
Along with him. The guide who has actually come back from there.
Who has been there to the top and comes back. That's what a prophet, prophet is. The holy prophet, prophets are those chosen people who have traversed that path towards Allah. And then they come back to take mankind along with
along
them.
Along with them.
And
very
so
beautiful.
We need, I mean, we're not, in this age and era, we don't have holy prophets, but we have those who follow in their footsteps, the ulama.
Yeah.
Ulama, not again just confined to teaching. The problem with our society is we have many teachers, many professors, but we don't have guides and mentors. And that is where we lack.
Yeah.
As a whole in society. Therefore, one of the previous sessions, I was presenting a model for that. I was saying, look, me as a parent may not be able to do that, but we, a few families, come up
together,
join up together, form a small community, find a person who can become a mentor. Maybe one of the parents can. Maybe one of the parents can. Outside of that community, we find a person and we ask him or her to show the path. So this is a model which needs to be developed in our society as a whole. Whether we live in, especially for those who live in countries which are not Muslim lands.
Okay.
Especially there.
So you're suggesting parents to make up groups with other Muslim families so that they can find a mentor within themselves and then who can actually guide the teenagers. It's not just parents as a whole can do that. A mentor has to be there.
Has to be there. And,
and your preferences about a mentor are that preference is that he should be ulama, he should be among ulama.
He should be not necessarily an alim, but he should have an understanding of Islam and the worldview of Islam. He could be a salih person.
Okay.
Not necessarily an alim in the true, full sense. But he is himself trained, has attained certain levels.
He possesses that worldview.
And that is important for the development of our society as a whole. We cannot just suffice today. I mean, we're quite happy. We say today, oh, there are so many programs on the internet which we teach our children about the Quran, but that's not enough.
All right. So you're saying that in our virtual world as well, even if we have online guides, even if we have online teachers, we got to have someone who teaches us practically, who teaches our teens practically. Thank you so much, Professor Nagavi, for being with us. And thank you so much to our listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.